There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine, to start with, is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to the January 2012 podcast. This month, we feature Kenny Kahn, proprietor of Blue Rock Vineyard in Geyserville, California. This podcast is sponsored by Waterford Wine Company. Find them on the web at waterfordwine.com.
To find a property that has been left unattended in wine country since Prohibition takes a soul with vision and guts. Kenny Kahn is owner of Blue Rock Vineyard, an estate winery located near Geyserville, California, and Kenny is just that soul. Specializing in reds, Kenny has taken a property already awash in beauty and created a vision for the future that further explores the pairing of food and wine. Kenny invited us for lunch and a tour of the winery just after Christmas Day in 2011. The sun was shining, the temperature was comfortable, and the wine was flowing.
So, well, welcome to Blue Rock. And I think, as you can see, Blue Rock is a historic property. This property was first settled in 1880, and Italian immigrants came in because Italian Swiss colony was just down the road in Asti. Matter of fact, it just closed just a few years ago. It's now owned by Chateau Souverain. So anyway, back in 1880, Italian immigrants were coming in with no money. They were basically dirt farmers looking for, like everybody else, the American dream. They came to this area because they had, you know, sort of like today's Hispanics who are coming in, is one relative would come here, bring a bunch of olive tree cuttings, some grapevine cuttings with them, start planting, and then get a little foothold, and then send for the nieces and the nephews, and then all of a sudden you have an entire, you know, culture from the old country.
I'm here with Kenny Kahn of Blue Rock Vineyard, and we're in Geyserville, correct?
We're just outside of Geyserville, between Geyserville and Asti, and we're up in the hills next door to Silver Oak Winery. And going back to the history of the Italian immigrants here, this is called Chianti Station. So not only did they bring olive tree cuttings, fig trees, and grapevines, and a knowledge and love of viticulture, but they also brought some of the family names with them.
Excellent. And we're going to be going on a tour of the property and talking about this. Actually, the day after Christmas, so I appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Okay, it's never worked for me to be at Blue Rock. And also, it's a gorgeous day here, so we got very lucky.
It is. It's a fantastic day. Where would you like to start, and we'll go from there?
Hey, let's start here in the garden, because this is the most beautiful part of Blue Rock, as far as I'm concerned, and it actually serves a purpose, a viticultural purpose, so I'll explain. So the garden that we're looking at, and the house, and the winery just beyond, these were all originally built and planted in 1880. So again, Italian immigrants came in just, you know, pursuing a better life here in this country. We don't know the entire history, although the winery was called Villa Maria. And we know that it produced wine and went out of business in Prohibition. And then from Prohibition until 1987, when I bought the property, it pretty much was just in neglect. But when I bought the property in 1987, all of the stone walls were here. The bones of the winery were there. And when I say bones, it's a three-story stone and redwood winery. So the stone walls were there. The redwood superstructure with the big beams was there. But there was no roof. The winery had ceased operations back in Prohibition, so it was really long gone. But I had a dream. I didn't realize it was going to take so many years, but I had a dream of recreating what was originally here and doing it to modern standards and doing it better. So that was from 1987, so what was that, 20-some-odd years ago that I've been, you know, developing the property and working on it.
What was your first vintage?
1999. So 1987 was when we planted the vines, and then we sold to other wineries on a contract basis until 1999 when we started making our own wine. So I hired Nick Goldschmidt. At that time, he was my consulting winemaker. At the time, he was head winemaker at Simi Winery. So I wanted somebody who was local, who knew Cabernet Sauvignon. He makes a very elegant style of wine, which is what I wanted to produce. He knew Alexander Valley Cabernet. So he became my original consulting winemaker, and he's still my winemaker today. So we're still a partnership.
Were you planning on making wine? Was that something you were looking at maybe just down the road? Or
I really had no plan. When I bought the property, well, let me back up for a second, is that I grew up in Memphis. In Memphis, we drank beer and Jack Daniels and didn't really know a whole lot about wine. And then one day, I had an older neighbor, a gentleman, Milton Picard, we called him Pick, and he tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, I've got this phenomenal collection of Bordeaux wines and some great California Cabernet, and I'm in my late 70s and my drinking buddies either have gout or they died or whatever. He says, you want to learn about wine? And I said, well, you know, I hadn't thought about it, but sure. And so I'd go over to his house, and he would open up, and I kid you not, first growth Bordeaux from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Some of them still had $2 price tag still on the bottle. Unbelievable, you know, when you think about the cost today.
Completely unbelievable by today's standards. Yeah.
Completely unbelievable. And so, you know, like all of us who love wine, there is that aha moment when you realize that, oh, this is really something unique and special, and I want to be a part of this. And at the same time, I met my wife, Cheryl, and we've now been married for 32 years. So Cheryl and I started dating, and she was a phenomenal cook. So she was in med school, but her hobby was cooking and painting and just was involved in the arts. And so I started going to cooking school, and you put food and wine together, and it's like, what are we doing in Memphis? You know, let's go. We don't have any kids. We had a dog named Aldo, the most beautiful Springer Spaniel. And we said, Aldo, get in the back seat of the car. Let's go. So in 1985, we sold what little we owned in Memphis. We didn't have kids. We didn't have a lot of real estate or property. So we were free to pursue our dreams. And I always joke that my dream was to come out and be a winemaker in California. My wife's dream was to get away from my mother. So everybody was happy. And I'm just kidding, Mom. So we found this property in 1987, and it was in foreclosure. And nobody wanted it because it is a very difficult ground to farm. Mm-hmm. So it's called Blue Rock because of the serpentine rock and pebbles and boulders on the property that are very high in magnesium. And because of that, what you get is a small, very unproductive vine. And if you back up the clock to 1987, the only way to make money in Alexander Valley at that time was to grow a lot of grapes, you know, a lot of tons per acre, mm-hmm. because the prices were like $500 a ton for Cabernet. So nobody even showed up to bid on the property. I was the only one. And I was so excited. I was so in love with this property that I was bidding against myself. It's like, do I hear 300? Yes. Do I hear 350? Yes. Kenny, put your hand down. But in the end, it was all worthwhile. So I bought the property, and you know, then reality set in after that. And the reality was that it was a wreck. It was going to take an awful lot of money to fix it up. Grape prices were extremely low, so it really didn't pencil out financially. So the good thing is I kept my daytime job. I was running a stock brokerage company. My wife was still is a radiologist. So from 1987 until about 1998, what we did is we kept our regular careers. And then, like any good boat, Blue Rock being the boat in this case, you know, required all of our money that we were making from our other enterprise. And, you know, it was really, it's really been a 30-year dream. And you do a little bit at a time. So from 1987 to 1999, we built the vineyards. So out of 100 acres that we own, 46 are planted.
That's a pretty healthy amount, though. That's pretty good. Most places you hear tend to be a smaller percentage than that.
Yeah, no, it's a decent-sized place. And of the 46 acres, we had decided early on to farm and style ourselves on the Bordeaux that we loved and grew up with. So we decided that we were always going to be an estate winery. And so in developing the property, we put mostly Cabernet Sauvignon, but we put 7 different clones of Cabernet Sauvignon, including some heritage clones. So the most recent one that's just coming into production, and we're excited because we're going to learn what it's all about, is a heritage clone where the budwood came from Nebom Coppola. Huh. So the winemaker, Scott McLeod, picked out 50-year-old Cabernet that was always their top lot. He took cuttings from the budwood, worked with UC Davis to get it clean, virus-free, put it into a nursery program, and we were one of the first ones to buy the budwood and start a increase block. So 7 clones of Cabernet Sauvignon. We have a clone of Cheval Blanc that came in Rex Geithner's suitcase. That is, so it's Cab Franc, where the cuttings came from Cheval Blanc. We have 2 different clones, including a heritage clone of Merlot. We have Petit Verdot, and then we have some sensational Malbec. And then in addition, mostly because I like it, we have about behind the house here an extreme hillside of 2.5 acres of Beaucastle clone Syrah.
So what you're doing is like the Petit Verdot, that sort of thing, you're blending then, I assume.
We're blending, yes. So everything is, it's all the wine that we make comes from the estate. And we blend, and the reason that we blend is that when you have an estate model, and in this case, by estate, I don't mean big wrought iron gates and, you know, there's the giant house. I mean it in the context of the wine business, meaning that everything comes from this property. So it's site specific. The grapes always come from this 46-acre vineyard. The winemaking is done here. Everything is done and controlled here. That's what I mean by estate. Estate model, you're limited to a certain extent. If you have a bad vintage or, you know, if you want to build complexity, you have to do so with what you've got on the property. And so Cabernet Sauvignon can be a little monolithic. It's wonderful. It's very black currant. But if you're making 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, to me, it doesn't have the layers of interest that I'm looking for in a wine. I want something that, you know, as you drink a bottle of wine, there's always something more aromatically, always something more with the flavor. And, you know, without making too much out of this, what you basically want is the last glass to be better than the first glass rather than the other way around. So those subtleties, you know, just don't come from one block of grapes. So what we do is we blend using different varietals, but also different clones of those varietals. And it's really amazing how different they taste.
About how many cases are you doing right now?
Well, we've grown to about 6,000 cases. And we make 3 different wines. So we make our entry-level wine. It's called Baby Blue. And it's called Baby Blue because it's the young vines on the Blue Rock Estate. And it's a red blend. So it's not Cabernet Sauvignon. It's a red blend that changes every year. What we're shooting for is a wine that is very accessible, but serious at the same time. So when I say accessible, we want something that when it's released, you can take it home and have it for dinner. You don't have to put it in the cellar. So it doesn't have big tannins. It has very ripe, delicious tannins, and it's ready for, you know, immediate consumption. But it also has layers of flavor. So the current release, 2009, is 39% Merlot, 30% Cabernet Sauvignon, 22% Cabernet Franc, and then the balance is Syrah. With the Syrah sort of giving it a, makes it unusual on the one hand, but it gives it a juiciness that everybody seems to love.
Gives it its own personality.
It really is its own thing. Then we make Blue Rock Cabernet Sauvignon. It's our flagship wine, and that comes from the older blocks of Cabernet Sauvignon. It's also a blend, so it's labeled Cabernet Sauvignon, meaning it's at least 75%, and in reality, ours is 90%+. But we do find that by putting small amounts of Cabernet Franc or Malbec or Petit Verdot or Merlot or all of those, that what it does is just makes it more interesting wine. Also, we're looking for a lot of flavor without heaviness. So I think, to me, one one of the challenges of growing all types of grapes in California is that we get so much sunshine that you get sort of a thickness and an oiliness to the wines, which a lot of people like, but I personally find undesirable, because what I want is something that is an accompaniment to food rather than being dinner itself. And so what we're shooting for is lots of flavor without the heaviness. And by blending in a little bit of Cabernet Franc and sometimes some Merlot or a Petit Verdot or, you know, a mixture, is we find that we get a wine that has the texture that we want. And that's a wine that has lots of flavor without the heaviness. Then finally, we make a third wine called Best Barrels. And Best Barrels is exactly what it sounds like. Matter of fact, the way we came upon it is in 2003, Nick Goldschmidt and I were tasting through every barrel of wine before we bottle and saying, okay, this one belongs in this batch. Maybe this one's not good enough and should be sold off to somebody else in the bulk market. But then there was this one barrel that was, whoa, baby, what's this? It was like, it was the wow wine. Mm-hmm. And it happened to have been Old Vine Malbec.
Really?
Yes, really. And
wow.
And Nick said, that's what Nick said. He said, wow. And he said, let's bottle this separately. So one barrel is 24 cases of wine. We bottled that separately, sold it all directly to our mailing list because there's so little of it. And everybody just loved it. And it's probably, it's one of the best wines that we've ever made.
Nice.
And so we said, you know, whenever we stumble across something that's really different and better, something really special, we're going to bottle a Best Barrel. So we didn't in 2004. In 2005, we made a Cabernet Sauvignon, which is just sensational. And then we made a Syrah Best Barrel, which Forbes magazine in The Good Grape called the wine one of the best wines that they've ever tasted and gave it, you know, a rave review. And of course, we don't make it anymore, unfortunately. That is just part of the wine business. Uh-huh. We didn't make one in 06. 2007, we made a Cabernet. We did not make one in 2008. And then in 2009, we made a Cabernet Sauvignon that is pretty remarkable. It's probably the best wine I've ever made.
That shows a great deal of integrity, though, that when you call it Best Barrel, you really mean that.
Well, I was listening to an interview on Charlie Rose today on the way up, and it was the interview with the gentleman who is the creative director at Pixar, and he was talking about Steve Jobs. It was really all about Steve Jobs and his role at Pixar. And Steve Jobs had a motto, and it was basically that quality is everything. And I thought, wow, you know, in the wine business, there's so much, you know, everybody's claiming passion and everybody's claiming that they're organic, and, you know, there's so much shouting going on. But then you taste the wines, you say, well, you know, but they're just not that good. You know, there's not many really special great wines out there. What I realize is that, you know, in the end, you can say whatever you want, but people are going to drink the wine, and it's either in the bottle or it's not. And so really, I don't want to steal from Steve Jobs, but quality is everything, because in the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine. So I think that, you know, what we're trying to do here is to do the best that we can do every year, to not have any compromises. In my former job, I had to compromise because we had owners and shareholders. And here, the only person who I have to argue with really is myself. You know, so there's an internal dialogue about the sacrifices that have to be made. Like if I sell off a lot of wine because I don't think it's good enough, then I have to take a financial loss by selling it off. The trade-off is that maybe we'll get recognition for being a great winery because we did that. So that's the faith that you have to sort of believe in, and hopefully it pays off.
Kenny, I mentioned when we came here that we saw your wine at a store, which was kind of funny. It's nice to see it, but, you know, when you see it, when you have a smaller maker to kind of run into them out of the blue like that just before you do an interview is unusual. So what about availability? Do you distribute it all?
We do, because we are growing. So we are in about 20 U.S. markets. We're in most of the major cities, and we are also in 5 international markets. So as of 2011, we started exporting to China, Hong Kong, Germany, the United Kingdom, and Canada. But we're more focused on the United States.
Sure.
I mean, this is our base. And our business strategy is to develop the brand one customer at a time, by selling one bottle at a time, rather than by hoping to be anointed by either Robert Parker, or I guess it's Antonio Galloni now, who's taken over the tastings for Robert Parker, or by the Wine Spectator. I don't know that we really have the style of wine that some of the reviewers seem to prefer. I mean, our style is really, it's about complexity, elegance, layers of flavor, taking a backseat to the food. And so if you're a critic and you're tasting 300 young Cabernets in a day, a Blue Rock isn't going to stand out. The only thing that's going to stand out is the one that's sort of bigger and bolder. Personally, I find the bigger, bolder, more extracted, more alcoholic and jammy wines less interesting when you're really drinking it and paying attention to what you're drinking, not just having a taste and then moving on to the next taste, but when you're really, you know, getting to know it. For example, with dinner, you need to have some subtlety and some layers of complexity. It's really a lot like people. Is that how many times have you gone to a cocktail party and you find somebody who's the life of the party and they're just, you know, they're bigger than life and so interesting, but they're really interesting for about 10 or 15 minutes. And then after that, it's like, you know, you're looking, you've learned all there is to know.
Yeah.
And wine is kind of the same way, is that, you know, it can't all be up front. I mean, there really has to be something that is revealing as you go through the bottle and also as it ages in the cellar. So if you have more than one bottle, you try it at different points in its life, and if it's a great bottle of wine, it's going to improve and, you know, and show its stuff.
In your opinion, do you think that some of these tastings that are done by these major magazines sometimes are, you know, when they're doing a number of wines in one sitting, the one wine prejudicing another wine really takes away from the idea of rating a wine? Would you agree with that at all?
Yeah, I think yes, I do agree with it. And I think it's such a shame that the numbers have such a big impact on the consumer. And I understand why they do, because I'm a consumer myself. That's how I got into this business. And sometimes you have to buy. You can't taste everything yourself, so you buy on the advice of somebody else. And there's so many wines out there that you just say, all right, I'm going to start off at 90 and go up, and I'm just going to disregard everything that's below 90. And it's such a shame. And really what I have found is that with some of the major reviewers like Parker, is that I really prefer the wines that get like an 88 or an 89, because they're really good, they're well made, but they're not that big, heavy extracted style. And those are the ones that I sort of gravitate towards.
I agree. I think, but it's more importantly to go into a store and just buy, you know, buy by the price of first what you can afford, and then go forward from there. And you'll develop a palate just doing that, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've discovered, and this is what's fun about doing consumer tastings, is that I'm on the other side of the table and I'm observing the different consumers. And I have generally three wines that I'm pouring, and they're at very different, they're different styles. So Baby Blue is very accessible, very juicy. The Blue Rock Cabernet, more layered, more structured, more sort of deeper black fruits. And then Best Barrel, if I'm pouring it, is more tannic, really in need of time in the cellar, but it will ultimately show its stuff. So in pouring three wines, what I find is that everybody's taste is different. As you'll have two people, a couple will walk up together and they'll taste Baby Blue, and then they'll taste Blue Rock, and then they'll taste Best Barrel. And, you know, half of them will like Baby Blue better than Blue Rock. Well, it's half the price. Still, if you prefer it, then that's the wine that you should be going for, right?
Who's to say that I should tell you what you're going to like and you should tell me what I'm going to like? I'm going to try your wine and I'm going to like it or not, right? And how many times have you been at tasting when maybe you and your wife have been completely opposed to a particular wine? You like one, she doesn't like it.
We always buy the one that she likes.
You're good. That's very good.
Well, she's earning the living, you know.
Great. Kenny, we were talking about when I drove up, obviously the road is lined with many olive trees, and you said that you do have your olives pressed for olive oil.
Yeah, actually, what we originally, going back to 1987, everything was grapes. So every square inch was planted with grapes. As we have been on a replanting cycle over the last 10 years, what I did is the areas that were underachieving as vineyards, I took them out and I planted olive trees. And then, so I did research on, because I love having different genetic material here, whether it's grapes or it's olives or figs or whatever. So I started doing research on olive trees, and I found a place in Dry Creek Valley called DeVero Olive Oil Company. And they had actually imported the genetic material for their trees from a particular Frantoio, a famous Frantoio in Lucca. And they started an olive tree nursery and also making wonderful olive oil. So I bought from them 500 trees. So we've started diversifying. So now, rather than just having grapes, we have olives and we make olive oil. And we have fig trees, peach trees, cherry trees. We make artichokes. We have our own vegetable gardens. I mean, so it's really now, I call it a farm. So it's no longer just a vineyard. And that sort of ties back into the estate model, is that we wanted everything to be available from this property. So when you have lunch here, you're having tomatoes and basil that come from our own garden, as well as the wine and the olive oil and the salad, you know, coming from Blue Rock. So what we did when the olive trees started producing, which was only 3 or 4 years ago, we made a deal with Dry Creek Olive Oil Company, and we sharecropped with them. So they came and picked the olives, took them over to their place where they have an Italian frantoio with a big granite grinding wheel, and we got 15% of the oil. Pretty sweet deal. And the oil turned out to be really spectacular. You're going to taste in a little while, because in the true Tuscan style, because of the trees. So the trees are Frantoio, Licino, Pendolino, and then a third one that I keep forgetting. I think it's Seviano. But it's a field blend. It's an intentional field blend so that they get ripe at different times. So when we pick in November, what you're getting is that true Tuscan oil that is big and creamy in the mouth, so it's like, you know, a big blast of cream, and then when you swallow, it's like, oh my God, there's so much pepper in there, you gotta almost have some water with it. So it's almost too powerful for a salad. You would use it on bread, you would use it as a condiment, you'd pour it over fish or chicken. Sure. It's just, it's wonderful stuff, and it's fun to have.
And when it comes to a property, what better to have olive trees on an estate, you know, to go with the wine, and with the grapes?
They also look beautiful, right?
They're absolutely stunning, especially when you come up the road.
So now we're in the original 1880s garden. So what we're looking at is what was originally a bocce ball court. And backing up the clock to 1987 when I bought the property, the stone was all here, but because of neglect and earthquakes, it had all fallen in. And we decided, you know, we're just going to rebuild it like it was. And so this was originally a bocce ball court. And then we hired Michael Bates as our landscape designer. He's a English plantsman who planted maybe 500 different species of ornamental plants. I mean, there's always something going on here. And it really serves a dual purpose. I mean, obviously, it's beautiful. In the spring and summer, it's just sensational. There's always, you know, something flowering and something, you know, beautiful going on. But for the vineyard, it serves as an insectiary. So what we have is just this, you know, wonderful population of insects who then go out into the vineyard, and the good bugs, basically, from the garden here will eat the bad bugs in the vineyard. And what you try to get is a harmony going, so that, you know, if you keep the bad bugs in check and you have everything that is harmonious, then you don't ever have to spray insecticides. And we haven't had to spray an insecticide here in probably 25 years.
That's an awfully good thing to hear, too, especially when it comes to farming. That's what it's all about, trying to keep it as clean as you can.
Absolutely. And what we do farming-wise is that we are not certified organic, but we are highly sustainable. Mm-hmm. And actually, on our website, I do a video chapter that is very specific about what we do. So the word sustainable doesn't just mean nothing at all. Our fertilizer here is only compost, and that's because I basically believe in it. The idea behind compost is that you're feeding the soil, and then the soil feeds the plant. Whereas if you use a chemical fertilizer and drip it in, basically you're feeding the plant. It's like a steroid. Mm-hmm. My feeling, and I certainly cannot prove this, but my feeling is that if I used a chemical fertilizer and the plant got this immediate result from it, and the guy next door is doing the same thing, then the wine is likely to have a sameness to it. It's not going to develop the personality. Whereas with compost, and it takes a long time, we put about 5 tons of compost per acre every year. What it's doing is building a soil culture. It's really building the microbiology that makes it possible for the plants to take up what's in the soil already, because the nutrients are already there. Grapevines don't need a whole lot. They don't want a whole lot. But sometimes it's bound up in the soil. And what compost does is by producing this rich microbiological life, it makes it so that the plants can take up what's naturally there. And so, again, my belief is that our vines are nourishing themselves on our soil, and so they're going to taste different than they do from the guy next door. And our soil is also very unique. Like I mentioned earlier, it's serpentine, which is challenging farming, but because of the very high magnesium, I think people tell me that our wines are distinctive, and I think that that's why.
It goes back to the whole idea of everything you're doing is as natural as you can possibly make it, which is as it should be.
It's as natural as we can make it. However, we're not afraid to intervene if we have to. And I'll give you an example of that. 2011, this is the most challenging harvest that I've ever had, and even old-timers, guys who've been farming for much longer than me, because I'm not an old-timer, they were telling me that it's the most difficult harvest that the most difficult season and the most difficult harvest. And frankly, because of the harvest conditions here, if you didn't spray for botrytis, then you wouldn't have anything to harvest.
Sure.
Because the grapes weren't getting ripe because of the cool year. Then we had the rains. Then botrytis set in. So if you didn't spray for botrytis, which is not organic, right, then basically you weren't going to have anything to harvest. So there are times when it makes sense to intervene, but we want to do it as gently as we possibly can and get the, we want the personality of the vineyard to come through. That's our main goal.
So you're talking common sense.
It's common sense, but it also costs money.
Yeah.
Is that it's cheaper just to use chemicals. You know, by doing it sustainably, it means many more tractor passes through the vineyard. It means more handwork in the vineyard. It means that the natural products like compost is much more expensive when you apply 5 tons of compost per acre than just getting a big tank of liquid nitrogen and putting it in. You know, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier is that, you know, in the end, if the quality is in the bottle, we will get the recognition. So the recognition is that people buy it, they like it, they tell their friends about us, they're willing to pay for it because they recognize that it's worth a little bit more money than the other wine that they didn't enjoy as much. And so, you know, in the end, it's worth it if we get the recognition. Let's head up to the winery.
Okay. We're in the cellar right now at Blue Rock Vineyard.
So this building is the original winery building that was built in 1880. And so it's 3-story stone and redwood. And this was rebuilt in 2006. And now we're using it for barrel storage. Mm-hmm. And what's wonderful about it is that it's like a European cellar. You know, it's really, when you go into a typical American cellar, they're absolutely spotless, clean, and all this, you know, everything is concrete. Here, we have 18-inch thick stone walls. We're below grade, so you can see that there's mold all over because of the water that's coming in through the stone. And It has a different kind of beauty. And the beauty for me is that it's a perfect cellar for aging wine because it could be 115 degrees outside, and in here it's always 65 degrees and very moist. Mm-hmm. We don't have to air condition it, so we're not using any power because it's naturally air conditioned by being below grade and by having the stone. And so we have, in a absolute packed capacity, we can put about 300 barrels in here.
Okay.
So that's maybe 6,000 cases altogether. And so this is where we do the upbringing of our wines.
And you do your own crush and everything here as well, I assume?
We actually have gone down the road to a neighboring winery where we do the crush,
okay,
but with all of our own equipment and our own winemaking, so we're basically just leasing space. And then we bring the, after it's fermented, we bring the barrels back here for upbringing.
Got it. Nice. Kenny, if our listeners would like to find out more about you online, how would they go about that?
That's easy. Our website is www.bluerockvineyard.com.
So, Kenny, I just want to say thanks a lot for giving us a great portion of your day and also making us a fantastic lunch and letting us try your wines. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much for coming out. It was a pleasure for me, and it was fun to get to try the 2004 Cabernet, which I haven't had in a number of years.
That was awesome, I have to say.
Thank you.
To learn more about Blue Rock Vineyard on the web, go to bluerockvineyard.com.
Watch for our February podcast, where you'll hear opinions and experiences from winemakers discussing the debate over corks versus caps. This podcast is sponsored by Waterford Wine Company. Find them on the web at waterfordwine.com.
Life Between the Vines was produced by Ray Pfister. Post-production was completed at Fifth Floor Recording Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Edited by Ray Pfister and our intern, Bob Warner. Original music composed by Tim Turton. Narrated by Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photography by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.